The Justice Department on Wednesday said it has filed war crime charges against four members of the Russian military.
The charges include conspiracy to commit war crimes, including war crimes outlawed by the international community after World War II, unlawful confinement, torture, and inhuman treatment.
Plus, U.S. President Joe Biden pleaded with Republicans for a fresh infusion of military aid for Ukraine on Wednesday.
We can't let Putin win. Say it again, we can't let Putin win.
And Israeli military continues to pound Hamas in Gaza with airstrikes and ground operations and say that they have eliminated militants and located weapons in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Today is Thursday, December 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. The Justice Department on Wednesday said it has filed war crime charges against four members of the Russian military accused of abducting and torturing an American during the invasion of Ukraine in a case that's the first of its kind. This is U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
We have charged four Russia-affiliated military personnel with war crimes against an American citizen living in Ukraine. The charges include conspiracy to commit war crimes, including war crimes outlawed by the international community after World War II, unlawful confinement, torture, and inhuman treatment. Like all defendants in the U.S. criminal justice system, the defendants in this case are entitled to due process of law and are presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Attorney General Garland says the four Russians are identified as members of the Russian Armed Forces or its proxy units. Two of them are described as senior officers. None of the four is in custody.
We allege that in April of 2022, two commanding officers of Russia-affiliated forces, Suren Suranovich Mukherjian and Dmitry Budnik, as well as two lower-ranking soldiers whose first names are Valery and Nazar, committed war crimes against an American citizen who has been living in Russia, who had been living in Russia since 2021. The victim was living in Milorovy, a small village in southern Ukraine, and was not participating in the armed conflict between Russia and Ukraine. As such, the victim was what is known as a protected person under international law.
Officials said the case marks the first prosecution against Russians in connection with atrocities during the war against Ukraine and is the first war crimes case involving the victimization of an American. VOA's Lori London asked Susanna Sokota, director of the War Crimes Research Office of the Washington College of Law at American University, about the potential significance of the war crimes charges against the four Russians.
I think it's significant. I think it's significant for a number of reasons. Number one, it continues to show the U.S. position in support of victims of the Russian invasion and crimes that have been pursued in the course of since that invasion. But two, it's really significant, I think, with respect to our own law. So this is the first time that the war crimes statute has been used in support of war crimes prosecution of the national, not of the United States, right? So these are nationals of Russia that have been accused of torture and inhuman treatment and unlawful confinement of a U.S. national, but the perpetrators in this case are Russian nationals. And that has only been possible because of a recent amendment to the war crimes law that basically says even if the victim or offender is not a U.S. national, if they're present in the country, in the U.S., they could be charged with war crimes. And that's something that advocates of, you know, accountability have wanted to see in U.S. law for quite some time.
The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin back in March.
Yeah.
We've heard a lot about war crimes happening in Ukraine. And the United States, while it isn't a member of the ICC, the Justice Department does apparently and has been cooperating with it and supporting Ukrainian prosecutors. Do you think we'll see more of this sort of thing here in the United States?
So that's a good question. I mean, I think this is a good indicator that there is there's willingness to do so. So under this war crimes law, one of the interesting things about it is that it requires that the attorney general or a delegate certify that the war crimes prosecution is in the public interest and necessary to secure substantial justice. And we see that happening with the announcement of the charges against these Russian nationals today. So I think that that indicates willingness and interest in seeking accountability.
So the four Russians, they're identified as members of the Russian Armed Forces or its proxy units. Will they ever actually see the inside of an American courtroom to face justice?
Right. I think that is a million-dollar question. Not unless they find themselves in this country. What the war crime statute allows is if they find themselves in this country, they can be arrested pursuant to these charges. But that's, of course, an extraordinary if. I don't foresee it happening. Nevertheless, I think this is a significant signal, again, of support for accountability for anyone who, Russian nationals or otherwise, who commit war crimes in the context of conflict, particularly now in the context of Ukraine and the conflict ongoing there. So I think it sends a very strong signal of the U.S. support for accountability in that conflict.
So even if it's just symbolic, it's significant.
I think so. I mean, the war crime statute has been on the books before the recent amendments, but not been used, and so I think this is really quite a turn, a shift in favor of accountability. And hopefully, we never know, right? We've seen other prosecutions under other statutes, the torture statute, for instance. Charles Taylor's son, Chucky Taylor, was prosecuted under the torture statute years back, but those are few and far between. And so I think this signals a real willingness to use the law in support of accountability.
That was VOA's Lori London talking with Susanna Sokota, director of the War Crimes Research Office at the Washington College of Law at American University. U.S. President Joe Biden pleaded with Republicans for a fresh infusion of military aid for Ukraine on Wednesday, warning that a victory for Russia over Ukraine would leave Moscow in a position to attack NATO allies and could draw the U.S. into a war.
We can't let Putin win. Say it again. We can't let Putin win. It's in our overwhelming national interest and the international interest of all our friends. Any disruption in our ability to supply Ukraine clearly strengthens Putin's position. We've run out of money to be able to do that in terms of authorization.
Biden spoke as the United States planned to announce $175 million in additional Ukraine aid from its dwindling supply of money for Kyiv. He signaled a willingness to make significant changes to U.S. migration policy along the border with Mexico to try to draw Republican support. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb for details of the package.
So now this is another package that's much of the same that we've seen over the past several weeks. It's about $175 million, and it includes missiles for air defense, like the AIM-9, the AIM-7 missiles. It has more munitions for HIMARS, those high-mobility artillery rocket systems that have really made a difference for the past year and a half on the battlefield, more 155 milliliter rounds, more 155 and 105 millimeter artillery rounds. In addition, they've got more javelins, all of these equipment that they feel that they need to protect the skies, because last winter we saw Russia repeatedly attack infrastructure, cities, anything that the Russians could do to try to break the will of the Ukrainians. They tried to freeze them out, so to speak. So in order to prevent that from happening this winter, the U.S. is trying to give the Ukrainians everything they need to not only defend their troops, but to defend the citizens inside Ukraine as well.
How long will this assistance last?
Well, I mean, we ask the Pentagon that every other week, and it really depends on how big the packages are. So when I was in Kyiv with Secretary Austin a couple of weeks ago, he announced a $100 million package. The packages in the past could get up as high as, about $1 billion. They have been significantly smaller over the past weeks, and that is because Congress has still refused to increase funding for Ukraine. They have not approved any funding. And that is problematic because while the Pentagon can continue to dole out this aid, they're going to have to give smaller and smaller packages in order to make it last. And that's not always a good thing, because if you may be giving them things out throughout the time that it takes to get aid passed, but when they don't have enough equipment, then you see shortages on the battlefield. And so the Pentagon has gone to Congress. They had a special session where Secretary Austin, I've been told by officials, laid out the problems with not providing Ukraine aid and with waiting and delaying. And basically officials were telling me that is giving Russia a leg up every time that you are keeping this aid in limbo. And by not approving the aid, the officials told me it is basically playing into Putin's hands.
The delay in approving this aid, is it within Congress?
It is definitely within Congress. Congress could fix this tomorrow by approving this supplemental aid packages for Ukraine. There's also aid packages for Israel as well. And this has been problematic for several weeks. This is not something that's new. The Pentagon thought that they could stave off any sort of consequences of this delay by slowing down, making the packages, like you see the one that was released today, smaller. But again, at some point, there's not much that can be done. And so the U.S. is going to have Congress approve this aid if they want to contribute in the way that they have contributed. Let's not forget, though, that the United States is not the only teammate of the Ukrainians, so to speak. There have been more than 50 nations as part of this Ukraine Defense Contact Group that have been coordinating how they dole out aid to Ukraine. And so what Secretary Austin and what officials of the Pentagon have told me is the only hope they have is that the European allies will step up to the plate while Congress is sorting out its aid issues. When this initially happened in Congress, when there was a delay in Ukraine aid, you saw nations like Germany really step up to the plate and provide bigger packages to Ukraine. How long will that last? Only time will tell.
That was my colleague, Kim Lewis, speaking with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres renewed his call for a humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, warning that public order could be completely broken down soon and the humanitarian system there is at a severe risk of collapse. In remarks, UN spokesman Stefan Duzaric says Secretary General Antonio Guterres has invoked the use of Article 99 of the Charter of the United Nations over the war in Gaza.
Article 99 states, and I quote, that the Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter in his opinion that may threaten the maintenance of international peace and security.
Israel military continues to pound Hamas in Gaza with airstrikes and ground operations and say that they have eliminated militants and located weapons in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. I spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem of this and other developments in the Israel-Hamas war. Linda, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday that Gaza must be demilitarized. What do you think he means by that?
Well, I think what he means is that nobody in Gaza would have any kind of military power, whether it was Hamas or the Palestinian Authority. And he said only Israel can make sure that Gaza is really demilitarized. So he's laying out a post-war Gaza that is very different from what the United States has talked about, in which the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank, would be strengthened and would eventually take over Gaza. So it seems that there will be some sort of clash down the road between what Netanyahu wants to see in Gaza and what the international community would like to see in Gaza.
I understand that the Israel military is continuing to pound Hamas in Gaza with airstrikes and ground operations, and they're eliminating militants and locating weapons in Khan Yunis. So what is the war situation now in Khan Yunis and in southern Gaza?
So Israeli military officials say this is the heaviest fighting of the war since it began. You know, there's a lot of Hamas resistance. They showed today a weapons cache that they had collected from southern Gaza, huge, huge amounts of weapons. So the fighting is really at its height now. In the last 24 hours, five more Israeli soldiers have been killed. Israel says it has killed dozens of Hamas fighters, and hundreds of civilians in the last few days have been killed in Gaza.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, in one of his most recent addresses, was marking the widespread sexual and gender-based crimes committed by Hamas during the October 7th attack. That's according to a rights group. What do you know about these crimes?
So there are almost all of the people who were killed on October 7th, the 1,200 civilians who were massacred by Hamas. Many of them were also sexually abused. Both men and women were raped, and rape was seen as sort of a crime, a way of humiliating people. And just today, we're getting testimony from some of the released hostages that at least some of them as well were also sexually abused while they were being held in Hamas captivity. Now, there are still an estimated, 138 hostages being held, including 11 women, two young children who the best estimate is probably that they're dead, but there are still 11 women. And one of the reasons that these young women are not being released is that they're, you know, at least according to Israeli analysts, is that they don't want them testifying to Hamas crimes. But what it means is that it, you know, puts a lot of more pressure on Israel to get the hostages released, which was happening, obviously, until that ceasefire broke down last Friday.
That was VOA correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. We're also following these other stories from around the world. Rescuers used boats to help people stranded inside their buildings in southeastern India amid widespread flooding caused by Cyclone Minchon, which has left 13 people dead and forced thousands of evacuations. Torrential rains preceded the cyclone, which made landfall Tuesday. At the COP28 Climate Summit Wednesday, a team of 200 scientists warned that the world is in danger of hitting a point of no return for five of Earth's natural systems because of human-caused climate change. The report on so-called tipping points are moments when the Earth has warmed so much that certain side effects become irreversible. On a visit to Cameroon Wednesday, Gabon's military leader pleaded with Central African states to lift economic sanctions on his country before the 2025 elections. But analysts and Gabon's opposition say reforms and construction projects before it returned to constitutional order is impossible and looks like a ploy to hang on to power. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia in a one-day lightning tour intended to raise Russia's profile as a Middle East power broker, even as his war in Ukraine grinds on. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Putin's begun a trip to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, hoping to shore up support in the Mideast from two major oil producers allied to the US as his war on Ukraine grinds on. Putin's arrival comes despite him facing an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court over the war in Ukraine. Neither Saudi Arabia nor the UAE has signed the ICC founding treaty, meaning they don't face any obligation to detain Putin over the warrant accusing him of being personally responsible for the abductions of children from Ukraine during his war on the country. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Italy officially told China that it will leave the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, the first country to do so since the project was launched a decade ago. Despite the decision, Rome still plans to maintain good relations with Beijing, government sources said on Wednesday. Officials from the European Union and China will hold their first in-person summit since 2019 this week, with leaders from both sides expected to exchange views on strategic and global economic issues. The number of candidates on stage is shrinking, but the fundamentals of Wednesday's Republican presidential debate may be familiar to anyone who has watched the previous three meetings. VOA's Kim Lewis has more.
The visual of the four Republican presidential candidates in Tuscaloosa, Alabama is notable. The three male candidates were in dark suits and red ties, with Nikki Haley, the only female candidate, in white. Haley outperformed all of her fellow candidates on the stage in past debates and has drawn attention from the likes of long-term Republicans because there's a perception that she could bring people together. However, all of the candidates appear to be confident that they have what it takes to be the next president. Kim Lewis, VOA News.
A Nevada grand jury has indicted six Republicans who submitted certificates to Congress falsely declaring Donald Trump the winner of the 2020 presidential election, making it the third state to seek charges against so-called fake electors. Fake electors were also charged in Michigan and Georgia, while 10 Republicans who posed as electors in Wisconsin settled a civil lawsuit Wednesday. Three people were fatally shot Wednesday, and a fourth person was critically injured in an attack on the University of Nevada, Las Vegas campus. The suspected shooter was also found dead. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue has more.
Campus Police Chief Adam Garcia says there was a report of an active shooter at Beam Hall, home of UNLV's Lee Business School.
Officers immediately responded, engaged the suspect. The suspect at this point is deceased.
Sheriff Kevin McMahill says there is no further threat.
Of course, we have no idea on the motive. There are a number of victims that have been transported to area hospitals.
This UNLV student, a junior named Matthew, was nearby. His reaction to the shooting?
Sadness that this is happening, but happiness that they've gotten here so fast. It seems like they were on campus right as it started, because the police, we have a really good response, I feel like, ever since our last shooting that we had here in Vegas.
Audio from KTNV. The UNLV campus is just 3 miles from the Mandalay Bay Casino. 60 people were killed in a mass shooting there in 2017. I'm Ed Donahue.
U.S. pop music superstar Taylor Swift has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Associated Press correspondent Tiffany Wang reports.
Time Magazine has named Taylor Swift its Person of the Year a week after Spotify announced she was the most played artist on its platform. Swift was picked from a group of 9 finalists that included Barbie, King Charles III, and OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman, among others. Her year included the wildly popular Eras Tour and concert movie, the release of her reimagined 1989 album, and her closely watched relationship with Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. She also took home 6 Grammy nominations this year. I'm Tiffany Wong.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, we see authoritarian governments that are increasingly intolerant of ideas, beliefs, and practices different than their own, said Uzra Zeya, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, at a side event during the recent International Religious Freedom or Belief Alliance Ministerial Conference. These authoritarian governments ignore and undermine internationally recognized human rights, democracy, and the rule of law, noted Undersecretary Zeya, who also serves as U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues.
The tragic events unfolding in Tibet mark just one example of this troubling dynamic. Tibetan Buddhism, a religion Tibetan Buddhists describe as rooted in compassion, empathy, and nonviolence, lies at the heart of Tibet's identity and cultural heritage. And yet, Chinese Communist Party officials somehow portray this religion of peace as an existential threat to the People's Republic of China, or the PRC.
For decades, Undersecretary Zeya said, the PRC has developed a draconian system of repression that aims to sinicize Tibetan Buddhism.
It seeks to subsume this rich and vibrant spiritual tradition into the PRC's political framework and reshape its core tenets in accordance with the values of the CCP.
Undersecretary Zeya cited the so-called patriotic campaigns that force monks and nuns to pledge loyalty to the Chinese state, the PRC's registry of officially recognized lamas, its clear intention to co-opt the succession of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and the government's restrictions on lay Tibetans, including prohibiting children from participating in religious activities. I am proud the United States continues to lead in bringing attention to the PRC's human rights abuses, said Undersecretary Zeya.
We will continue to increase international solidarity in support of Tibetans' human rights and preservation of their unique cultural, religious, and linguistic identity. We continue to call on the PRC to resume meaningful and direct dialogue with the Dalai Lama or his representatives without preconditions at the highest levels of our government.
The United States' resolve is unwavering, declared Undersecretary Zeya, and we will continue to work tirelessly to advance the human rights and dignity of all Tibetans.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.